Okay, my name is Tarek. I'm an alcoholic, and we're before I turn it over, we're going to start with the set aside prayer, and then it's Adam Carey show. Moment of silence. God, please help me lay aside everything I know. These steps, this program, this book, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with this disease, these steps, this program, this book, myself, and especially with you, God, please help me see the truth. Amen.
Okay, so we wanted to cover, you know, steps one and two in this time that we have allotted. And, of course, you know, step one is such an extensive, I mean, when you look at the amount of attention that Bill spent in writing this book and laying it out, I mean, he spent a significant amount of time talking about step one. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, alcoholics, we're delusional creatures. We don't have denial. Al-Anons have those. We're delusional. You know, so on some level, you know, you need to say something 75 different ways before I'm, like, even remotely willing to, consider that it might be a possibility. The other thing, too, is because knowing who and what you are is an incredible, incredible aspect of this process of recovery. You know, knowing your own truth and knowing deep down inside who and what you are. And the other part of it is that alcoholics, we need to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. And often our own experience does that. But one of the significant things about alcoholism is that my experience will beat me into a state of reasonableness for about 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden, I'm a little less reasonable. So the other reason why, you know, the step one is such an extensive chunk of this book is because, you know, we really want to look at alcoholism from all of these different perspectives and really be beaten into a state of reasonableness in such a way that that our ego will not reconstruct and convince us that, you know, somehow these things don't apply to me, because that's really the crux of step one. Is, you know, there's a solution, or there's something I must do. And what I need to do is to believe that I have this problem to such a significant degree that the program or the practical application of the steps apply to me. Because alcoholics, myself, have this delusion that I can be just like you, but somehow I'm just ever so slightly different, and therefore things don't apply to me. Rules, musts, requirements, you know, they don't apply to me. So, you know, step one, you know, we don't want, I mean, obviously this is a study, and I mean, we're not going to go through it in such extensive detail because we just don't have the time. You know, and the thing is that, you know, if you're sitting here to study and this is your first brush with step one, you need to find somebody in this room who has been through this work and sit down and read it with them. One. Because, you know, workshops are wonderful. They're definitely a great opportunity to broaden and deepen your experience. But if this is how you're working the steps, please don't. Because this is not sponsorship. This is fellowship of the spirit. And the other thing is people often mistake this stuff that happens at this table as sponsorship. This isn't sponsorship. I'm practicing the 12 step, right? Because I'm carrying a message. I'm carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm also participating in the fellowship of the spirit because we're all here loving God, loving AA, doing our deal. You know, this is not sponsorship. And sponsorship, what sponsorship really is something that's incredible and intimate and real. And so I think a lot of times I used to, you know, go to workshops and I would highlight my big book. And I highlight my big book and I write down everything everybody said and I'd have my Cliff Notes version of the book. And, you know, and I would think that, you know, something was transmitted to me. And there's really something about sitting eye to eye with somebody and reading this book. Now, I hope you're going to hear things here this weekend that, like, light you on fire. Maybe things that you haven't heard before, or is something you heard before in a different way. I mean, I hope that we do that. I hope we do give you information. I hope that this isn't redundant for you. You know, so I hope that there's some aspect or something that we're going to do that is going to be, you know, new and different for you. You know, and if you have questions about that, ask me afterwards. Ask Adam afterwards, and we will detail it to you eye to eye. But, you know, so what we're really going to do is kind of do a drive-by on, you know, the important aspects of step one. And but, again, we wanted to put this spin on it with the two ideas that what we really wanted to work with this weekend, which is, you know, what does the practical, what does it look like when you practice these principles in all our affairs? What does that look like? You know, I mean, that's one thing, again, when we know what the principles are. Well, what do they look like in action? And creating the vision of God's will for us so that we can carry this into all our activities. And creating that vision and carrying it into our lives and say, again, you know, can we go deeper? Can we go further? I mean, can we use this unbound energy that I have for, you know, creating destruction and chaos and harm to others? Can I, like, you know, redirect that in such a way that I can actually live a life that, is beyond my wildest dreams? You know, and what does that look like, and what do we want to do? I want you to leave here, and I want you to think about all the aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, because that's the other thing, too, is that as a big book thumper, I was very blinkered, and I had tunnel vision, and I was all about carrying this message, and I was ambitious in Alcoholics. Who the fuck would be ambitious in Alcoholics Anonymous? Think about that for a minute. My sponsor used to call me, he used to say that I was I was trying to be a somebody in a program full of nobodies, which he thought was just ridiculous. So, you know, we can get kind of ambitious about this, you know, fighting over newcomers, who wrote the best inventory, you know, who gave the best talk, and who's got more sponsees, you know, the toaster drive sort of stuff. Because alcoholics, we're weird like that. My ego will create something about anything. So, you know, I can do that. Certainly within the context of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I think that often that energy is misdirected because I focus so much in here that I forgot I had a life. You know, and this is a bridge. This is about us being involved in all aspects and these principles and that energy going into all aspects of our lives, not just in the context of what I do in my home group, but my community as a whole, who I am as a whole. So I also, you know, we want to kind of talk about that sort of thing. You know, can we have a more holistic approach to life in general? Or am I going to have that laser focus? Because I found that when I had that laser focus in Alcoholics Anonymous and I only applied that energy to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't always all that successful. And now that I'm, like, kind of chilled and I'm, like, all about just enjoying Alcoholics Anonymous, it's incredible how much... How much the quality of my service has just increased within Alcoholics Anonymous. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we also want to talk about. Like, you know, who are we going to be in our communities? Who are going to be not just, you know, in A, but in our families, in every aspect of who we are and our identity? Can we bring these principles there, or maybe I am, or maybe I'm doing it 75%, but maybe I can up that to 85. Mm-hmm. You know, we can always go further and deeper with our experience. Making sense to you all? All right, so you want to...
This quote actually jumped out at me last night. I was reading it, and it ties into what you were just saying about the hopelessness and the reason that we need to kind of really understand what we are, and it's on the back of your little pamphlet here. It says, inwardly the alcoholic brooks no control from man or God. He, the alcoholic, is and must be the master of his destiny. He will fight to the end to preserve that position. You know, and that's me to a T. You know, even sober, I still, you know, I was talking about this over the summer a lot, because I was in a very transitional point. I was in that point where I know I need to do the process again. I know I need to get into this again, but I don't want to. I'm fine. I'm okay. And what it is you know, I know in my gut that if I wake up in the morning and I say, God, what do you got? And I go about doing that for the day, my life is awesome. And I know in my gut that if I wake up in the morning and I say, screw you, I got this, I'm gonna run the show, my life is gonna suck. But on any given day, I still try to run the show. You know, and that's what this, it brings me back to this idea of step one, that I need to be convinced, you know. And that's the cool thing. Yeah, I think this, I even behave this way still to this day, but it doesn't last. You know, that's the cool thing. Whereas it used to be where, you know, I would run this self-will thing and not even realize it. And that's the delusion that Kerry was talking about. You know, I never, you know, to me the concept of delusion and denial is knowing the truth but somehow suppressing it and just kind of telling myself it's not true. And delusion is I believe my own bullshit. You know, you stick me up to a lie detector test and I will pass with flying colors. You know, I will be able to handle it this time. I'll be able to do it with whatever the problem is, whether it be with the booze, whether it be with self-will. I can handle this. And I believe it. You know, so that's the, you know, that for me is the real deal with this step one, being sober, you know, because I had a real hard time. I remember, you know, the first time or the second time going through the steps, I was very keyed into this powerless thing, you know, and the allergy and the obsession and how alcohol I couldn't control it. But being sober for a few years, all of a sudden you start to kind of lose that a little bit. It's intellectual, you know it, but on a gut level, you can't really tap into that because, you know, I haven't drank in 18 years. I haven't thought about drinking in like, what, 15 years, you know. It's how do you tap into that powerlessness? And for me, this is it. Right here, you know, me being the master of my universe, me controlling self-will, me controlling my life and managing my life the way I want to. That's where what brings me back to that place. That's what disconnects me from my God. And which brings me back that if I'm disconnected from my God, I got no power. You know, I'm a hopeless, powerless alcoholic. Yeah, I've got power today because I got down on my knees and I prayed and I asked God for help today and I invited him in. But if I wake up and I say, fuck you, I got it, there's no power there. You know, there's no power there. So I'm still, you know, a hopeless, powerless alcoholic.
And we you know, one of the things, and I'm sure you guys have heard this, the real alcoholic, right? Okay, well, we like hopeless variety better. And there's a reason for that. It's because, well, when you say real alcoholic, it just sounds snarky and mean, honestly. you know, and the thing is that I like to talk about the hopeless variety of alcoholic. I like to use that when I'm talking about alcoholism, the hopeless variety. And the book actually talks about, it says, you know, it does talk about the real alcoholic, but it also talks about the hopeless variety. It says, you know, it says that Bill, you know, was a hopeless alcoholic. It talks about being doomed. It talks about, so I mean, I like to use that better, because I think that it, I think the first time I heard somebody talk about the real alcoholic, I remember actually I called up Dave. I was so upset. I was 25 and I had like maybe like 7 or 8 years sober, and I heard and everybody was ranting about the real alcoholic, and I'm like, oh, I got sober at 18. Now, you heard my story last night. I'm a real alcoholic. But I'm like, I don't qualify. What if they kick me out? They're going to kick me out. What if they find out that I'm not a real alcoholic? Now, I had been qualified. I had been working the steps for years. I've been sponsoring for years. I call up Dave, and I'm like, they're going to find out and throw me out of AA because I'm not a real alcoholic. And what if I have to go to one of those crappy fellowships and I end up in Al-Anon? Okay. I go to Al-Anon, by the way. I go to Al-Anon. But, so, and he goes, well, did you ever have craving? Well, yeah. You ever have a mental obsession? Well, yeah. And he goes, I know you got the spiritual malady. He's like, well, then you're a real alcoholic. Go away. You know, but that's my point. And sometimes when we hear that term, it feels like it's an exclusionary term. I like the idea of the hopeless alcoholic, because the fact is that, you know, if you have those three things, you know, if you have the physical allergy, you have the mental obsession, and you have the spiritual malady, you're hopeless, and it really doesn't matter how much you did or didn't drink. And so for me, it just seems to be a more inclusive term. So we're going to use that term, the hopeless alcoholic, you know, and it's really interchangeable with the term the real alcoholic, but I just think it's a little nicer. And it also puts it in terms of what it really means, because, you know, the idea is we're hopeless apart from divine help, you know, which is the whole point of the first step, is to convince us of that.
There are a lot of people in our fellowship today, you know. This book was written in, what, 39, 38, give or take, you know, something like that. And 99% of the fellowship, or 95% of the fellowship, were hopeless variety alcoholics. There was no fellowship. You know, these people, they died, they went to nut houses, and they died, or they ultimately found this. And so, yeah, 95% of the people who this book appealed to were hopeless alcoholics. Today, it's not the case. Okay? I got no statistics. This is just an opinion, and it's not in the book or anything like that. But I'd say 60% of our fellowship are type 2, bordering on type 3 alcoholics.
And we'll go through the types so you know what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah. And they don't need a spiritual solution the same way that I do. Okay, it doesn't make them any less an alcoholic. They're just not that far down the scale yet. They haven't gotten to the place that I'm at yet. They will, because alcoholism is a progressive illness. And I know for me, my illness hasn't stopped because I got sober. You know, it just manifests in other ways, and it keeps, you know, poking its head up over here and over here, and there's money in there, and there's sex, and there's jobs, and there's control, and, you know, and all this other stuff, you know, and that's how it manifests. It grows. Now, this type 2, type 3 alcoholic, they can stay sober for a couple years, and they can come to meetings, and they can get plugged into the fellowship, and they can go to the diner, and they can don't drink and go to meetings and talk about their bullshit.
Until they shoot themselves.
But eventually, that's the point. Eventually, they either shoot themselves, or they do the work.
Or drink.
Yeah, or drink. Yeah, up in my neck of the woods, you go to a celebration meeting. We have celebration meetings once a month. And you see a whole bunch of people with 90 days, and a whole bunch of people with a year, and then a few people with 2 years, and then even less people with 3 years, and then nobody until you hit about 8 or 10 years.
Yeah.
And then you get a couple sprinkling through.
And then you have the old farts.
Yeah, and then you have the old farts.
Years.
But the reason for that is, and I've just watched this over the years, is that about 2 years, this type 2, type 3 alcoholic can stay sober going to meetings. They can stay sober on the fellowship. And at 2 years, they hit a wall. And they either need to go through the steps or they want to die. And most of them at 2 years aren't so invested in Alcoholics Anonymous and their ego in AA that they pick up a drink.
Actually, the guys with the invested in the ego
are worse.
They're worse.
I was just going to say that.
Working with them.
Some people stay.
Yeah.
Some people stay. You get that sprinkling of people that make it through, and then they hit 8 years. And at 8 years, they start thinking about eating a bullet.
You ever work with somebody who's like 9, 10 years sober, hasn't touched a step, and is completely stark, raving mad?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know.
And try to convince them that what they think they know about the step process and God, really, they got to lay that aside, and like, really, how is that working for you? You know, cheating on your husband, hate everybody, you know, spending problems this, and blah, 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 that, and I'm miserable and I want to die, but I have 8 years and I worked really hard for those 8 years. Really? I really don't want what you have, man. Do you want what you have? No. Put it away. And so, you know, and that's it. That's the thing is, like, you know, we become so attached to our persona within Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and so, you know, again, like, when we're talking about the first step, we're really talking about it in all of these levels. We're talking about it at the very simple level about me and a bottle. We're talking about it in terms of me and my alcoholism, You know, the ism aspect of this, you know, the spiritual malady or that we talk about. You know, we're talking about it in all of these terms, and what we're trying to do is get us to look at where we are with all of this right here, right now. You know, and the idea is that, you know, my ism might be manifesting in terms of a bottle. It might. But today, because I've been invested in Alcoholics Anonymous for as long as I have, it doesn't anymore. My bottles come to me in other forms. They come through the back door. They come in terms of unmanageability. They come in terms of delusions that I have. They come in on that level. You know, they come in terms of you know, my agnosticisms. So we're going to talk about it in all of those terms. So, you know, I mean, again, I think we'll just take maybe 20 minutes and just hit the important points of the first step out of the book, just so that we know that we have. Because one of the things is, like, we have to operationalize our definitions. We need to have a common language. You know, you know, you walk into a meeting and you meet somebody and they just say that one thing and you know they're a thumper. You're like, ah, yes, you're one of me. We're speaking the same language. So part of this is, you know, part of just starting with these things, and these are probably pretty redundant for you, is to have that common language. So that when I'm talking about craving, you're not thinking mental obsession. When I'm talking about, like, because I don't know how many people say, I'm craving a drink. How long since you had a drink? 3 weeks. Then you're not craving a drink. You're using the wrong word. Words are really powerful. I mean, one of the coolest things is that one of my sponsors, she was a writer and she was a college professor. She was an English professor, so she kind of graded my four step. She's great. But one of the things that she did is she really impressed upon me the power of words. There are certain words I had to take out of my vocabulary. I had to change the way that I spoke so that I can change the way that I thought. Because, I mean, we hear ourselves. When I speak, I'm hearing myself and I'm processing that information and I'm encoding it again. So the things that come out of my mouth are really important. So I needed to recognize the power of words. And like I said, it's like, you know, we established that operational definition of saying that when we're talking about the hopeless alcoholic, we're talking about the real alcoholic, but we like hopeless better because it's fuzzier. You know, it's a nice, fuzzy, warm thing instead of a judgmental, condemning thing. So the power of words. So what we want to do is we want to be able to have that common vocabulary, that common worldview, that common ground, so that as we're going through this and we're referring to stuff, we know that you know what the hell we're talking about. I'm sure you all do, but I want to make sure that we do so that there isn't confusion and so that we can be more effective in this weekend.
Roman numeral 23, doctor's opinion. The bottom of the page says, I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed. Our house meeting was named after this line, because it was labeled the last house on the block. Yeah.
So a lot of people are working in the fourth edition, so it's page 25.
Oh,
sorry.
That's
about
right.
That.
I'm sorry.
I got the fourth.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give the Roman numerals.
Okay.
I'll give them pages for you.
Give the Roman numerals. But yeah, our house meeting was named the last house on the block because the idea is have all other methods failed? All other methods failed. Have you tried everything that you can do?
How's that Prozac working for you? How's that porn doing? You know, has that shopping addiction, has that done anything to, like, curb your alcoholism?
You know, and the bottom line is, though, is if it's working for you.
Box
you
to drop.
If it's working for you, you know what? There's a meeting down the street that you can go to that you can share about your day. That's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea is we brought this up in our house because what I found is that people who are working the fellowship and doing the don't drink and go to meetings and sharing about their issues of the day and all that stuff, they show up at our house and we don't warn them ahead of time, they end up drinking.
Yeah. Or we scare the hell out of them.
Exactly.
Like they accidentally show up in our living room and they're like, fuck, man! What the hell is You know,
because you got to be to this place, you know, and that's why part of the reason we brought up the concept of the hopeless variety, because unless you're a hopeless variety, unless you all other methods have failed, you're not going to go to God. You know, you're not going to do what this book asks us to do. You know, so if what you're doing is working, do it till it don't.
Yeah. And the thing is that you can become hopeless at 8, 10, 15, 20 years
mm-hmm.
with abstinent from alcohol. I mean, because that's the progressive aspect of this disease, and this is exactly what we're talking about, is you can put down the bottle, and you can spend 10, 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous and have your alcoholism beat you into a state of reasonableness. You know, I mean, that's the wonderful thing about alcoholism. It kind of really doesn't care if you're putting booze in you or not. And so that's really one of the things that, you know, that I want to focus on, too, is that when we're talking about the hopeless alcoholic, we're not just talking about it in terms of what you put in your body as far as alcohol. We're talking about alcoholism as a whole, mind, body, and spirit. And when we talk about the hopeless alcoholic, it's mind, body, and spirit. I'm not just talking about your relationship to the bottle. Because at a certain point in this book, it says we leave the drink problem aside and we look at ourselves. Because if I'm my trigger and I'm my problem, then the bottle itself is somewhat irrelevant. Because honestly, if I address myself in terms of this process, the bottle really does become irrelevant. I mean, dude, I count controlled medication for a living. I hand out opiates. I hand out, you know, benzos. It's like Scarface, you know, like, you know, there's like piles of controlled meds. One, two. If I wasn't a recovered alcoholic with an EDA, and if I wasn't placed into a, if I wasn't put in a place of neutrality, safe and protected, you know, I'd be in jail. You know, I mean, because I'm a bartender, essentially. I am a bartender, and and for me, because not only am I an alcoholic, but I'm also a drug addict, and I'm a benzo addict, and I'm an opiate addict. So basically, I go to work every day, and I fondle my substance of no choice. If I wasn't safe and protected, if I wasn't a recovered alcoholic, or I wasn't a recovered drug addict, I'd have a real serious problem. So I'm not, you know, I really want you to think about this, is when we're talking about this, we're talking about mind, body, and spirit. We're talking about alcoholism, you know, as a whole, you know. And so, you know, if there is an unmanageability in my life, if there's a delusion that I'm carrying, or if there's something going on, I could have a suddenly at any given point. And there's nothing to stop me because I count the meds, so I can lie. I mean, think about this. It's like I'm the person who counts them. If I wanted it to look as if I, you know, like there were supposed to be a few less, I could do that. And I can do it with impunity, and I don't, because I'm safe and protected. How did I get here? What is it that I did? And that's really kind of what we're talking about. But, you know, we're talking about alcoholism from a holistic perspective. So if you're 10 years away from a drink, it doesn't mean that you're not a hopeless alcoholic. I'm a hopeless alcoholic. You know, the only difference between the untreated alcoholic and myself is that I've been able to tap into that power, which has been able to restore me to sanity, you know, and allow me to be effective in my life. But, you know, I want you to start not to think about it in terms of just your relationship with the bottle, but your relationship with your ego, your relationship with yourself. Look at and think about all of the things in your life, all of the aspects of who you are, your personal identity, you know, and think, do I have some hopelessness there? You know, how effective am I? How is it working out for me trying to run that aspect of my life? XXVR.
The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life. That we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that the bodies of the alcoholics were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete.
So I don't drink just because people are mean and my life sucked.
I don't drink because my mommy didn't love me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't drink because I was raised by wolves, according to her.
Yeah.
You know. you know, all those external situations that, you know, we grew up with and that we have in our lives and whatever, yeah, they contribute to my behavior, you know, and cause me to have more consequences or more external issues in my life, but they don't cause my alcoholism. You know, my alcoholism is underneath all of that. I'm a firm believer, you know, there's the debate, you know, for, you know, do you become an alcoholic or are you born an alcoholic? You know, and I've met people who became alcoholics. You know, they drank for 30 years and they crossed a line and they became alcoholics. I'm not that type. You know, I was listening to a speaker a few months ago, and it resonated with me so perfectly, and it sounded so good, I gotta steal it. I was a freeze-dried alcoholic. Yeah, just add alcohol, instant alcoholic. Because I can't be an alcoholic if I don't ingest the booze. But the second I did, it was over, because everything else was already there in place. All I needed was that craving. You know, and none of this other external stuff is the cause. It may exasperate it. It may cause me to come here sooner. It may cause me to have other issues. But it's not the cause.
Yeah. You know, and that's it. Kind of like what we were talking about last night about attributing external conditions to our alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact is that, you know, the problem is within me. And the solution is within me and God. And that's where I need to get with that, and I need to get with that right quick. Because, you know, when I don't know how many times I've had a woman approach me, and she's, you know, stunningly beautiful, leggy blonde, and I'm like, oh, God, do I have to sponsor another fucking Barbie? Seriously? You know, size zero, perfect perky tits. I'm like, Jesus, man. If I hear her whine about being fat, so help me God, I'm gonna hit her with something. But here's the thing. I sit down across the table with Barbie, and she's a fucking mess. She's stunningly beautiful. College degree, lawyer this, yada, yada, that. And she's the most hopelessly insecure, insane, demented mother, you know. And so, you know, the thing is that, you know, that there's the wonderful thing about alcoholism is that it has absolutely no prejudice, you know, and it cuts across the board. So we might look at somebody on the outside and think, dude, you don't know shit. And in reality, their inner pain is so much more horrendous than anything I could possibly imagine. You know, and I might look at somebody and they might be scruffy and they chew tobacco and they forget, you know, holy, you know, jeans, the backwards baseball cap. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you just rolled out of the trailer park, dude. And you know what? And I'm judging on the outside, and in the inside, they are like the most incredibly God-centered, on fire, lightning bolt, God, you know, rays of sunshine flying out of their ass human being. You know, and so, you know, when we're talking about this, we're talking about inside. We're not talking about about the outside. We're not talking about external circumstances. And again, I'm going to repeat that, because we use external circumstances in order to manage our alcoholism. Well, if I have the right tits, I'm good. If I lose that 5 pounds, I'm good. If I get the right boyfriend, I'm good. If I drive the right car, I'm good. If I get the right job, I'm good. If I can just rearrange all of the, you know, all of the seats on the Titanic and polish the brass, all will be well. No, it's all going down, man. So, you know, we really want you to think about it in terms of what's going on inside of you. Yeah, and I stole that from Fight Club. Hobbs and the Titanic. Yes, yes, yes. I'm really not that smart.
You spoke the first rule of Fight Club.
Yeah.
What are we at? This is 26. My 26.
We believe. Okay, yeah.
We believe.
XXVIII.
We believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence and their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them, and they become astonishingly difficult to solve.
Really?
Great.
Isn't that interesting?
Great, great passage for a newcomer, and a great passage for a young person. Okay, I've worked with a lot of young people, and so have you. And actually, she's my example because she wasn't even legal to drink when she got sober.
I wasn't legal to drink when I was sponsoring.
And I've worked with a lot of people who didn't drink a lot of booze. A lot of drug addicts, and they didn't drink a lot of alcohol. Did you ever experience craving even once? That's the qualification there. You know, did you ever experience it even once? You know, I had a hard time recognizing craving. I was talking to somebody about this before the session, and because I never drank to control on any level.
What was the point?
But not even to the point. It was like my goal was to get as whacked as possible as quickly as possible. You know, every time, and so that. I drank a little too much tonight. It got out of hand. Never happened in my life. So I had a real hard time grabbing onto craving. And it was this line that saved me. The guy who was bringing me through this part of the book and what we were talking about it, he's like, scour your memory. Find an experience. And I found one. I found one experience that I can identify with craving. And I was dating this girl. And we were at the bar. And she asked me to not get too wasted tonight and have a couple, you know. And she lured favors over my head as a motivation. And I did it. I did it. I drank the two beers and I went home and. But I had to look at my attitude that night, and I had to look at how I felt. Was I a happy-go-lucky guy with a nice little glow going, thinking I'm going to get laid?
Mm-mm.
No, I was a miserable douche the whole night, you know, because my body's screaming at me saying, you need more, you need more, you need more. One time, that's all I needed, and I can identify with having the craving of alcohol.
And it's funny, too, because, you know, so that definitely wasn't me, because if he was sober, then I would. And I'd be the only sloppy drunk, and that doesn't work. But you know, and again, you know, it's really, and like I said, if we're new, young people, this is really important. It's like, and I had a very similar problem for the very same reason. You know, I didn't even bother with, like, you know, containers when I drank. I was like, I didn't have cups, like, you know, like a wine glass. No. You know, straight out of the bottle with the, you know, with the paper bag. That was more my deal, or the, you know, jug of Gallo, whatever it was. You know, I really didn't, and I had the same problem. And one of the things, and it was like when I told you I had that moment of, oh my God, I'm not a real alcoholic, they're going to throw me out of AA. It was actually his sponsor, the very same person who sat with me, and he asked me. He was like, you know, one time, and it's like, and for me, I had a year abstinent from alcohol, not from other substances, but I was hanging out in AA doing non-conference approved, and we went out to drink. We decided to relapse. That guy said crackhead too many times,
and
greasy crackhead. So we left. We left the meeting, and we went out to drink. And I drank, like, you know, after having not drank for a year, I drank copious amounts, and then I had to carry him home. I was like 95 pounds, and I carried him home because he was a mess, and I kept drinking. And I woke up the next day, and I needed to drink. And I swore I was going back to AA. I swore I was going to go back. I was like, oh, I'm just going to go out for one night. I'm 18. I deserve to drink. And I couldn't come back for 4 months. I drank every day for 4 months. And I could not not drink on a daily basis. You know, so, and it was like, because I didn't think about it in those terms. I was like, because I never tried to just have one or two. But I had to think about it as like, if I went out and drank and I got completely wasted, and then the next day I woke up and what, you know, when I came out of the coma that I was in, you know, what was my first thought? It wasn't a cup of coffee and a cigarette. It was, you know, I need a drink. And that's craving. That's my body requesting alcohol. You know, and so, you know, like, again, you know, maybe some of you guys have had that experience of going to the bar or just having one or two and being miserable. I didn't. I never had one or two. Maybe bottles, but I didn't bother with that. I told you, like, from the gate, like, I just said, I'm an alcoholic. This is what I am. I'm just going to die, and if I die of alcohol poisoning, cool. So I had to look at it in those terms of, like, you know, if, you know, did my body crave alcohol after you know, coming out of whatever coma I was in?
Down at the bottom of the page, it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again.
You watch alcohol? Mm-hmm. You an alcohol watcher? You ever watch somebody drink? You know, out to maybe a family dinner with non-alcoholics? Glass down. And you're just watching that glass. And it moves around the table, you know, because that's the thing about alcoholics. You know, it talks about watching other people drink with impunity, and it occurs to me that, like, you know, I'll know when I have the alcoholic mind. I know exactly where every single drop of alcohol is in the room. I know where it is. I'm watching. You're talking, and I'm watching you lift a glass to your mouth. You know, I'm getting that warm buzz just watching you drink. Because, you know, like, that's that thing, that's the alcoholic mind, that attachment to alcohol, that perception, you know, that other people, I want to drink. I don't want to drink like a non-alcoholic because that's fucking boring. What I want to do is I want to drink like I do without getting in trouble. You know, that's the truth. I don't want to be a non-alcoholic. I want to be an alcoholic who gets away with it, you know. But, you know, and that's that mindset that we have, that we watch other people drink, you know, we're constantly aware of. And why do you get away? Why can you drink and I can't? You ever think that? You know, that's the alcoholic mind. That's the untreated alcoholism within us.
It uses the term restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, and to me, that's my natural state. That's not caused in my life. That's not because of alcohol. That's my natural state.
That's your resting.
and alcohol takes that away. It says that unless he can experience that sense of ease and comfort by taking a few drinks. You know, you ever have to go to work and you can't drink and you finally get to the end of the day and you take that first drink.
I didn't go have a job where that was required.
Yeah, you know, or you go to school or you do whatever you do, but...
No.
And that's that sense of ease and comfort what comes at once by taking a few drinks, you know. And then the craving kicks in. So, you know, this kind of contradicts a bit of what the fellowship tells us. You know, the fellowship tells us that we put the plug in the jug. You know, they tell us, you know, don't drink and go to meetings. They tell us all these things.
Bring the body and the mind will follow.
There you go. That's a good one.
Bull crap.
Okay. According to this paragraph, the driving engine here is restless, irritable, and discontent, my natural state. If I address the restless, irritable, discontented feeling, I don't need to get that feeling from taking a drink. And once I take a drink, once I don't take a drink, the craving doesn't kick in. You know, so I don't put the plug in the jug to feel better. What I do is I deal with this this internal condition that's going on inside of me. Mm-hmm. It tells us later on that, you know, once this spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So we get with God and everything else falls into place. Yeah. And that's been my experience. I'm the type of alcoholic. I needed God yesterday. I don't need him a year down the road to get the spiritual part of this program. No, I need it yesterday so that I can stay sober for a year to get, you know, down the road.
And it talks about not being able to differentiate the true from the false. And, of course, that's the delusion of the alcoholic, and that life seems like the only normal one. And, of course, again, that's it. That's more about our perception of ourselves in the world, you know. And again, you know, it also has less to do with what we say about our drinking. I mean, I want you to extrapolate everything that we're talking about in terms of when it says, oh, you know, the alcoholic's life seems like the only normal one. We can't differentiate the true from the false. I want you to take it and say, okay, well, if that applies to my drinking, where else does it apply in my life? Where else am I not able to differentiate the true from the false? I'll tell you what, I'm one of those women who, like, you know, will work out obsessively, and I know exactly what I ate yesterday. I know exactly how many calories are in it because I have that kind of OCD mind, you know. So a perfect example of that, you know, when we're talking about, you know, can't differentiate the true from the false, is that my mind will say, well, Carrie, if you lose 5 pounds, you'd be a lot happier, you know. I'll believe that. And I'll believe that if I could just look better on the outside, everything else will just take care of itself. People will like me more. I'll have more friends. I'll have more this. I'll have more that. And really what it's about is, you know, about me being insecure and needing to feel better or superior to other people. And God forbid I not be the best person in the room. But, you know, I'll believe that. So I won't be able to tell the truth from the false on that one. Or that we need more money. Or I need that Prada bag, you know. Again, where am I not able to tell the truth from the false? Where is my alcoholic life seem like the only normal one? I've said things. I remember I was in college, and I'm sitting around this table with a bunch of these little kids. And at that time, I kind of passed for being, like, you know, 20, and I was almost 30. And I'm sitting around with all these kids, and I said something that we were talking about high school, and I was like, I said, well, you know, like my, you know, I was talking about my boyfriend who was like 24 when I was 14. And like this, my friend turns to me and he looks at me and he goes, you dated a pedophile? I was like, is that how normal people see that? I saw that as being, you know, opportunistic. I saw that as me being very advanced for my age. I was precocious. And other people think about it like a 24-year-old man, you know, man dating a 14-year-old girl is being, like, you know, a sex crime. And I'm like, oh. Yikes, I probably should keep that under my hat. But you see my point. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. That seemed perfectly normal to me. It didn't occur to me that anybody else would think that was untoward.
We're almost to the time,
yeah.
So I want to...
Yeah, no, I figured we'd fast forward to those solution.
No.
Oh, to the wives. You wanted to do
the
wives.
Yeah, I wanted to do that.
Okay.
In the doctor's opinion, I'm not going to... I don't know the page for you guys, but it says there are many situations where... No, the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail outside the scope of this book. Mm-hmm. I don't want to read the classifications in the doctor's opinion.
They're
because
they're boring
and they're confusing and they really don't make a lot of sense. But on page 108... The chapter to the wives, it talks about four types of drinkers. Okay, you know, on the bottom of 108, it talks about type one, and you know what, we can leave type one alone because we don't have any type ones. You know, he's a heavy drinker. He's not really an alcoholic. Blah blah blah. But type two, your husband is showing lack of control. For he is unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive that he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying dry. Maybe he's beginning to lose friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He worries at times and becomes aware that he cannot drink like other people. He sometimes drinks in the morning and through the day also. He holds his nervousness in check. He is remorseful after serious drinking bouts and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over the spree, he begins to think once more how he can drink moderately next time. We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. Okay? That term, real alcoholic, again. Dude's not a hopeless variety, but he's got all the earmarks of a real alcoholic. And in my experience, the majority of Alcoholics Anonymous today is this guy. Okay, we have such public knowledge about what AA is. We have such public knowledge about alcoholism. Everybody knows. It's all over TV. It's all over everything.
Shit, it was in 90210 when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Dylan went to AA.
Yeah, so, you know, people are coming into AA a hell of a lot sooner than they used to. Type 2 is a real alcoholic, and he's the majority of Alcoholics Anonymous today.
But he ain't the hopeless
variety. But he ain't the hopeless variety. He doesn't... Walking in the door, he does not need this book. But he
Page
still needs us. He still needs us. Because we... He's going to get there. He just ain't there yet. So the idea is, and this is what I've been practicing for a really long time now, is how do I bring this message to this guy?
Yeah, because if we can get this guy and get him to work the steps, then he'll stop killing people like me.
Exactly. If I can sponsor this guy and bring him through the work, he'll stop saying, just put the plug in the jug and life will be good. You know, he'll stop telling newcomers, all you got to do is sit back, relax, and listen. You know, because he can. He can do this, but if he works the steps, he can carry a message. A type 2 alcoholic can work with a type 4. He can. He's just got to know that he's got to know the deal, and he's got to have done it.
And he's got to know what a type 4 looks like, because
yeah,
you know, it could, because again, we, you know, the thing that is common in all of us is that those three things, the physical allergy, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady, they express themselves in different ways. Each one of us, our alcoholism expresses itself on an individual basis, but we have those three common symptoms. And once, if we can line up on those three common symptoms, and we can get people to identify with those three aspects, it really doesn't matter whether or not you're a type 2 or a type 4. This process can be applied, and it does fit. So, I don't try not to dismiss those people when I'm in the rooms. Like, I go to the shaky, smelly one because, you know, they really need me. But I also really try to put my hand out to the people who seem like they're okay, mostly. But they, you know, you could tell, like, they got a little squirrel in their eyes, but they're not completely nutso yet. But they're, you know, give them some time, and they will be. Because if I can get that person to go through the work, you know, then I'm actually increasing the chances for the next person who comes into the door. Because now we have somebody, I've got somebody who, with maybe 5-8 years, who's gone through this work, had this tremendous transformative experience. Maybe they weren't as hopeless as I was when I got here, but now they have all. Now they're getting their sponsees and their sponsees, and they're stopped lying and crying. They're not talking about fucking bubble baths. They're talking about something real. They're carrying a message with depth and weight, and we start infecting meetings by working with all types of alcoholics, not just the bottom of the barrel. And you'd be surprised at how successful you can really become with that. But we have to be able to identify so that we can tailor how we're carrying this message. If I walk up to the soccer mom who's like a type 2, and I start talking about sucking dick for booze, that ain't gonna fly. You know, but I start, really. She gets that horrified look. And then she thinks, I'm probably not going to come back to this. But I start talking to them about their alcoholism, find out what type of alcoholic they are, and then I start talking about the solution in a way that they're going to understand it. And so I start talking about the problem and the way they're going to understand it as well. So I start talking about, you know, about hiding the booze and those sorts of things. I talk about trying to look normal, about putting up that front. on the outside and dying on the inside, and I got her. I don't have to talk about sucking dick. I got her on that. You know, but so we have to be able to identify that. So part of knowing these types of alcoholics is really going to help us not only in our own lives, you know, as far as the practical application for ourselves, but how we're going to carry this message and be more effective as a whole.
When I walk into a meeting, I'm not necessarily sharing to the type 4 anymore. You know, I'm not sharing to that hopeless variety anymore. I used to walk into meetings, you got to find God or you're going to die. You know, that was my approach when I walked in. Today, it's not like that at all. Because what I've done is I've learned how to share publicly to reach each one. Now, I will go and grab that shaky guy after the meeting and tell him he's gonna die if he doesn't find God. But when I'm sharing in a meeting, just a regular share, not a speaking commitment or anything, just a regular share, I'm sharing to the type 2. You know, because then that'll cross all the lines.
Type 4
will still hear what I'm saying because he's identifying with the malady. He's identifying with the craving. He's identifying with the obsession. I don't go in there and talk about how much I drank or how horrible it was when I drank. I talk about those three things, and I talk about the solution. And it reaches all of them.
Can you say those three things again?
Physical, allergy, mental obsession, and spiritual malady, the three aspects of the first step.
Yeah.
You know, and I swear to God, every Saturday night at the speaker disgusting meeting that I go to, you know, I raise my hand, I say, hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic, and I spent many years in Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing what an alcoholic is. This is what it means to be an alcoholic. When I put alcohol in my body, I can't control how much I drink. And I can't control and enjoy my drinking. I have a mind that says that's normal, and I have a spiritual malady that says that I suck. And then I launch into whatever else I'm going to say. I say it every fucking time. Because I figure if I keep saying it, it's that, you know, people begin to understand what it means to be an alcoholic. I'm not just raising my hand and arbitrarily identifying, not diagnosing myself. There's criteria that I'm meeting that is what designates me an alcoholic. And so every time I share, I say something along those lines, and you can see the old timers going. But you know how many people have come up to me and been like, "That's what it means." Oh shit! I was like, "Yeah, come to my house. We're gonna talk about this." There's this book. He's like, "Oh my god, there's this blue book, man, and it tells you exactly what an alcoholic is." Holy shit, let's go read it. You know. So the idea is if we hit those three things and we talk about it in terms of those, it's very easy to be able to carry this message and get people to identify their alcoholism or identify them or disqualify their asses. I don't know how many people are like, dude, you're not an alcoholic. Go to Al-Anon. Go knit. Find something else to do with your time. You really don't belong here, man. Don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way up. You know, so it works in both levels. We're trying to qualify people to bring them in, but also I've sat down with enough people who didn't meet that criteria where they really just looked at me blankly. Like, and I'm like, dude, get a hobby. Seriously. Go take a class. Go spin. I don't know what. But, you know, but get the fuck out of my program.
Ouch.
Yeah. I told you he was the nice one. And I apologize for it, but honestly, you know, so it works on both levels in that way. Because I've shared that, and I've had people come up to me and like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm like, ooh,
yeah,
let's talk about this.
Sure.
You know, I'm addicted to people.
What? She's raising her hand.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No worries. So, just to clarify, so like, type one is the only one that is not hooking up with the physical allergy, the mental obsession, and spiritual malady.
Well, I mean, he's the heavy drinker who may or may not become the alcoholic.
He's the heavy drinker that may or may not cross over.
So we don't even talk about him because usually he doesn't even wander in here and he's somewhat irrelevant to us.
Yeah.
Type 2, type 3.
Type 2, type 3, and type 4. And of course, type 3, it says, you know, he's gone further than 2.
He's the guy that wants to want to stop and can't control it. And then the type 4 is the hopeless variety who's been
jails,
in and
institutions,
out of, yeah, jails,
and death.
Jails, institutions, and death. And he's been in and out of the rooms, and he can't stop, and he knows he's an alcoholic, and he just can't do it.
That guy goes into seizures in your car as you're driving them to detox?
Yes, that's him. Yeah. And then he's not in the book, but there's a type 6. You know? Some of us know about this guy.
He's the guy who's actually worked the steps and still drank.
Yeah. Is it? Are we going to take a break?
No, 10:30 is the break.
No, 10:30 is not the break, is it?
Yeah, 10:30 is the break.
Oh,
I don't know
shit.
Why you were freaking out, but I let you do.
So, oh, okay. My bad.
So, yeah. So we have these types. So we want to become familiar with this, and we want to be able to identify these people as we're carrying this message. And, of course, we want to be able to identify ourselves. You know, and the joke in our house is that, you know, Carrie drank like a type 3, but she has a spiritual malady like a type 6. You know, so, and we want to be able to do that, and we also, like, in the idea is when we carry a message, we want to be able to read a room, you know, and it's amazing, people talk to me, and they're like, how do you know how to, it's like, have you ever read Working with Others? I mean, it's all in there, man. You know, it's all about, it's like, you know, find out about the alcoholic, and then, you know, then, you know, as you're talking to them, you know, tailor what you're going to say based on what you found out about them, you know, so, I mean, really, you know, and then we want to be able to do that. You know, and so